Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
What do you say that we unify this party at this crucial moment when unity is everything?
As to Hillary Clinton, the charge of putting herself ahead of America, guilty or not guilty.
And it is my honor to be able to throw Donald Trump over the top in the delegate count tonight with 89 delegates.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Voices from Cleveland, Chris Christie, Paul Ryan, and Donald Trump Jr. having their moments at the GOP convention last night. Tonight, Ted Cruz stalks the convention, trying to appeal to his, in many cases, angry foot soldiers. We'll hear from a few of those in a moment. This is also the moment for Mike Pence, vice presidential candidate, to shine in Cleveland by formally accepting his nomination. The proceedings in Cleveland have got you talking. Any moments stand out?
Donald Trump Jr. was actually a great speech. I really loved it. I like the way he's talking about, you know, traditional conservative issues. I thought his education point was awesome. I really love the way he's just becoming more conservative. It wasn't like that in the beginning.
All I could see was the hatred for Hillary, and it seemed like that's all anybody talked about. It was almost obsessive to the point of pathetic.
Well, the official theme of tonight's proceedings is Make America First Again. Newt Gingrich fits into that theme, apparently, and will be speaking tonight. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is in Cleveland and says there are plenty of people in Cleveland not buying these neat themes.
Well, John, I got to tell you that many of the speeches last night absolutely electrified the crowd here. Donald Trump Jr., his son, extolled his father's virtues as a parent and a leader. Chris Christie played the prosecutor and listed off Hillary Clinton's crimes and transgressions and really whipped the crowd into a frenzy, chanting, "Lock her up." Those were unifying moments, and they were huge. But, John, behind it, there has been a lot of unrest and disunity on the floor the first half of this convention. And the speech to watch tonight is from Texas Senator and one-time Donald Trump rival Ted Cruz. Cruz speaks this evening, and he still has a ton of foot soldiers in this crowd, many of whom have been livid at the way the RNC has run the convention, and they say shut out their delegate votes. Sandra Ziegler is a pro-Cruz delegate from Texas. She's going to be listening very closely to Ted Cruz tonight. She's going to have breakfast with him today, and she wants to know that Ted Cruz is still running for president in 2020.
You know, I'm expecting him to preach the blessings of liberty. I really am. Give a full-throated apology for why conservatism is really indispensable in our party. And I do not expect any sort of thing that would sound anywhere close to an endorsement from him of Donald Trump. There's a lot of conservatives who are in his camp. He's got that ground game built, and he's maintaining contact with those people for the next time around. And I don't think he's going to give that up.
Are there a lot of holdout voices like Sandra, and are they from all over the country?
Well, John, it's important to say that this is not the majority of delegates on the floor. Donald Trump won this nomination yesterday, and the majority of delegates do support him. But there are a lot. There are many, and many I've talked to who've been just plain angry. Let me take you to the Alaska delegation last night, where during the roll call of states, where the states put in their votes to the chair to nominate the party's choice for president of the United States, the Alaska delegation went up in arms, thought that their votes weren't counted properly. They had many votes for Ted Cruz. They had many votes for Marco Rubio and votes for Trump, too. But the chair recorded their votes as unanimously for Trump, and the Alaska delegation went crazy. David Donnelly is one of them.
We announced there's 12 votes for Cruz, 5 votes for Rubio, and 11 votes for Trump. And they counted all 30 for Trump. And they never asked us. They never contacted us. They never said anything. They cheated me out of my vote.
The RNC is corrupt.
Well, the Alaska delegation is pretty up in arms. Are they going to make more noise as this convention continues?
John, Judy Elledge is another member of the Alaska delegation who was pretty clear about her feelings after the dust-up.
My last convention. They don't have my respect or anything, and I'm tired of it. If they think bullying and silencing people helps his movement, it doesn't.
And John, Judy Elledge told me that she's done with the Republican Party after this. And she said she won't help Donald Trump get elected the way she's helped with other candidates. Now, that might not be a big deal in Alaska where the Republican's going to win no matter what, at least most likely. But I got a similar sentiment from Chris Morrill. Now, Chris is a Cruz delegate from Arizona who said he runs several Facebook groups with thousands of members in support of conservative causes and conservative candidates. He's phone banked and canvassed for other candidates, even ones that aren't conservative enough for his liking because they're Republicans, and he wants them to win. Chris Morrill told me that after this convention, he's rethinking all of that. This audio is a little bit crackly because we were right in front of one of the speakers with the rock and roll music playing.
When you shut out the conservative base and treat them like sore losers or radicals, then you're telling them you don't need them. Why should you expect them to support you?
And then, John, I would just take you back to where we began to Sandra Ziegler from Texas, because she told me that she has traveled at her own expense from her home in Texas to a swing state to canvass for the Republican nominee for the last three elections, including 2012.
I mourned and I embraced our eventual nominee, Mitt Romney, and I went to Cleveland, Ohio, right here in Cuyahoga County, and knocked on doors in the rain for a week as Hurricane Sandy was blowing in. I have never been in a spot where I couldn't support our ultimate nominee. And I find myself there now.
But are you going to go to Ohio or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin for...
No, I don't see myself doing that. I think all the Trump supporters who basically told us to take a hike and that all of our concerns are stupid, they can go man those phones.
That might mean President Clinton.
Well, I guess we'll see, won't we?
Do you think that's a widespread view that Clinton is preferable to the... anger that the Trump supporters have aroused in all of these Cruz supporters?
It's not a widespread view that Clinton is preferable because Hillary Clinton makes these delegates cringe. And so what would they actually do in November? Some of them might come around. They might feel a little bit better when this convention is over. But the important thing, John, is not necessarily how these people cast their votes. The important thing is what they do between now and then, because these are the Republican foot soldiers. These are the people who pay their own money and take their own time to come to conventions. And they're the people who will phone bank and get online and raise money and talk to their neighbors and knock on doors for a candidate. And you're hearing from delegate after delegate right now who've done it in the past who say they're just not doing that for the Republican nominee this time around. They may wind up voting for Donald Trump, but they're not going to work for him. And if your foot soldiers aren't working for you, it can be a huge liability.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
The summer of 2016, is it a throwback to George Wallace in the 1960s?
I was safer than a B-29 bomber over Japan during the war in an air raid than the people of Washington are walking in the White House neighborhood.
Paris is no longer the same city it was. They have sections in Paris that are radicalized where the police refuse to go there. They're petrified. The police refuse to go in there. We have places in London and other places that are so radicalized that the police are afraid for their own lives.
That's Donald Trump speaking to MSNBC back in December. What do you think of that comparison? Trump has also been compared to the insurgent Ronald Reagan. He's been called an American version of the popular hedonist Berlusconi of Italy, who was also a populist. If you ask the campaign, they say Trump is closest to Richard Nixon, a solid or unfortunate comparison, depending on your reading of history. Rick Perlstein has studied all of that history. He's the author most recently of Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. He's currently in Ohio covering the convention for the New Republic. And he says he's surprised by how straight-edge Republican this convention has been so far, partly because Trump is still hard to define.
He really fractures what we understand about the Republican past. Of course, some things he holds to the light and we see it kind of quite clearly. You know, we have Paul Manafort, you know, saying he's going to be borrowing Richard Nixon's 1968 speech.
Actually, the Nixon 1968 speech, if you go back and read that speech, is pretty much in line with a lot of the issues that are going on today. And it was an instructive speech.
And it's not particularly original to do that. I mean, for going on 50 years now, the lion's share of Republican campaigns have made law and order the keynote of their appeal.
Children without fathers, in neighborhoods where gangs seem like friendship, where drugs promise peace, and where sex sadly seems the closest thing to belonging.
So that's part of the Republican thing that is quite continuous.
Well, let's listen to Nixon's speech that Manafort referred to, and we will figure out if this is a matter of outsourcing or another glib political comparison here.
We shall reestablish freedom from fear in America so that America can take the lead in reestablishing freedom from fear in the world. And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice.
Is every work of political theater at these conventions, in some sense, a form of plagiarism?
You know, you, John, I'm sure heard that he referenced the phrase freedom from fear that is associated with none other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So, yeah, I mean, I think that every politician who's successful is throwing these kinds of tropes in a blender. And there really aren't that many of them. You know, it's kind of stick with what you know is one of them, or we need change.
Where is the Reagan coalition today in the ways in which Trump has really stirred the pot?
Very complicated place. One of the things I remember in 2012 when I was at the convention in Tampa was when, you know, people like John McCain and Condoleezza Rice gave their speeches talking about America as the indispensable nation that needed not retreat from its role in the world. The response from the people on the floor was very tepid. And so Trump speaks to that with his, you know, kind of annoyance at America as the nation builder. But at the same time, even though it was National Security Week at the convention on Monday, none of the speakers really spoke to those Trumpian themes too either. So that's very confusing. And then another thing that he's playing with that's kind of been this tension within the conservative coalition really from the first is that these kind of economically libertarian laissez-faire notions that the government should retreat from everything was never popular. Even in 1984, when Ronald Reagan won his 49 states, the polls showed that people wanted just as much regulation as they did in 1976. So when Trump kind of abandons that part, you know, the kind of free trading stuff, for example, he's very much following what the Republican base has always wanted but never really received from their politicians when they've been so disillusioned by the people who haven't delivered their goods.
Rick Perlstein is the author of Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, and he's covering the convention for the New Republic. Donald Trump needs young voters, and he doesn't have many outside of Cleveland, according to CBS News pollsters. They estimate that Trump's unfavorability rating among this demographic is about 75%. The loss of the youth vote in the 2012 presidential race was one significant factor in that election's outcome, with Mitt Romney losing the youth vote to Obama by a 23-point margin. Alex Smith is the national chairwoman of the College Republican National Committee and an alternative delegate. In speaking with the Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick, she says that if the GOP is looking for something that resonates with young voters and embodies Republican values, then it's probably staring them right in the face.
I think one of the best ways to communicate to young people today that small government and free market principles work for them is a smartphone. You know, a smartphone is something that empowers us from the bottom up to make our own choices. We can choose among many different things, basically learn anything, communicate with each other, and consume products and information in ways that our parents and our grandparents' generation couldn't do before. How does a young person today who has that experience in the consumer world, in the education sector, and just in their lifestyle, square that with a government who wants to fit everyone into the same healthcare box? It just doesn't work.
I've never met a young Republican or any Republican under 30 who believes in free market principles like you do, who didn't think that serious cuts needed to be made to entitlements like Medicare and Social Security to either do away with them because they don't agree with them or to make them more solvent for the future. Donald Trump doesn't agree with that. Donald Trump has said many, many times to keep Social Security the way it is. He's tilted that part of his platform very much towards older voters and not towards conservative principles at all, much less young ones.
Well, I mean, I think that if in your own experience of talking to delegates on the floor and just talking to people here, there isn't one flavor of conservatism. There isn't just one way of thinking about the Republican Party.
Spending programs can just stay the way they are or grow. That's new conservatism?
Look, we have a big tent party. We have a lot of ideas. We had a big conversation leading up to this convention. And I think that where young people are concerned about these programs is the solvency. In fact, when we did focus groups and research in 2013, we asked young people in those groups, what do you think makes your generation different than other generations? And one of the most heartbreaking answers that I got was, we're never going to see a dime of Social Security. That's never going to be there for us.
This is exactly my question, because the nominee doesn't agree with that. And it's not just a side issue that I'm getting at. It's not some small bore issue. These large trillion-dollar entitlement programs are at the core of the economy, as you know, and at the core of conservative philosophy.
But it's also not the only issue that voters and young voters are interested in this election. I mean, this is the most heavily indebted generation in the history of our country, whether we're talking about student loans or we're talking about credit card debt. This is a generation where 3 in 10 are living back home with mom and dad because they can't afford to go out on their own. They're scared that they're not going to get that piece of the American dream that was promised to their parents and to their grandparents. And so I think that there are a number of different issues that young people are concerned about this election. And, you know, of course, the future of big entitlement programs is one of them, but it's not the only issue.
Young Republican voters who are looking at the Trump candidacy in this case, why? What else is he bringing that they lack?
I think what he is bringing, first of all, he's bringing an authenticity to the table that they feel like Hillary Clinton is lacking. You know, he's the kind of guy that's not bought off by special interests, that he's not saying something because someone's in his ear telling him he has to say it, whereas they very much feel that about Hillary Clinton in some ways. So I think that what he's bringing to the table for a lot of young people is this idea that he's the turnaround CEO, that he's gonna fix Washington. And what I find particularly interesting is I've had a lot of conversations with friends and family who are, you know, young voters in Pennsylvania, my home state. What I've found listening to them is an interesting undercurrent to what they're saying, which is, you know what, we don't know necessarily what we'll get if we vote for Donald Trump. But if we don't vote to make a change this election cycle, things may never change again. We may never have this opportunity. And I think that that's a very powerful undercurrent for the Clinton campaign to fight against, and one that all the money in the world isn't going to move.
Alex Smith is national chair of the College Republican National Committee, graduate of Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and native of Pennsylvania. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
There is another important election that is happening this year. The UN Security Council will choose a new Secretary General before December. It's not a vote of the member states, but there is a widespread feeling that the last 10 years at the UN have been rough ones. Last week, 10 of the 12 candidates debated live on television. Though the Security Council is not obligated in any way to select the most popular candidate, the member state preference would be for a female Secretary General and one from Eastern Europe. Both would be firsts. Someone like Vesna Pusic, a former Deputy Prime Minister and Member of Parliament from Croatia.
First, I happen to be a woman. I don't think this is enough. I happen to be a feminist, and I think this is important.
Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, who is also the first woman to head the UN Development Program, is also running.
When we look at the scale of the challenges our world is facing, we need a global search for the best talent. This is a critical job.
You can't imagine the terrible frustration it is to see people suffering and not to have a solution for them. And this was the reason why I believe I had the obligation to present myself as a candidate to Secretary General.
Antonio Gutierrez is the Argentinian former head of the UNHCR, responsible for refugees. But perhaps the most interesting moment of the debate was a question from the moderator about Haiti.
Most scientists you talk to believe that the UN peacekeepers brought cholera to Haiti. So maybe we can have a show of hands. As Secretary General, would any of you admit responsibility and apologize to the people of Haiti? Who would do that?
That pause was the moment before Cristiana Figueres of Costa Rica raised her hand, alone among the other candidates. Misconduct by peacekeepers, whether as sexual abuse, corruption, or in this case, creating a deadly public health crisis in Haiti, has sullied the peacekeeping mission of the UN for decades. Jean-Marie Guaino was Undersecretary for Peacekeeping Operations from 2000 to 2008 and now is the president of the International Crisis Group. He says immunity from prosecution and other protections are the only way to ensure that nations contribute peacekeepers, but abuses have put all that in a whole new light.
Especially if you deploy in a country where the justice system has broken down, you don't want the troops to become hostage to a system that could be manipulated for political ends. At the same time, I think there is a real problem today in the sense that you do need to have accountability for the troops. And for that, I think you would need treaties to make sure that there is somewhere a jurisdiction that can address abuse by peacekeepers when they happen.
Who is responsible for the peacekeepers if there are complaints, if there are real problems on the ground? Is there a place within the UN where you can take those charges and indictments?
The responsibility is with the troop contributing country, because no country that contributes troops would want to surrender that authority. The problem is that some countries do the right thing. When there is an abuse, they have a court-martial, they take action, and others don't. And then the only leverage of the UN then is to say, well, thank you very much, but we don't want your troops anymore.
And it sounds like that kind of punitive step is very rarely taken.
Yes. No, I think that is really a big challenge for the credibility of peacekeeping. More than 10 years ago, there was a report which was written by the present High Commissioner for Human Rights. And that report made a series of very concrete propositions on court-martials on the ground, a series of action that could be taken. But it has met with enormous resistance from troop-contributing countries.
Why?
Well, first, there are discussions in the UN on what is the right chain of command. The troop-contributing countries want to keep some control over their troops. So the UN is never in a very strong position in the command and control chain, especially when the going gets rough. And that is a big political problem for the UN. At the moment, most troops come from developing countries. There are a few troops from Europe. There are no troops from the US. And it is mostly the developed countries that want more and more ambitious mandates. And so you have the traditional troop contributors who say, well, very nice, you're asking us to take more and more risk, but you're not sharing in the risk. You're paying the bill, but you're not paying the price of blood. And so there is a tension there between the different categories of peacekeepers.
What rhetoric, what speech, what move on the part of a new Secretary General would satisfy you that perhaps the UN is capable of turning the page here on some of these issues?
Well, I think the next Secretary General should really emphasize that today peacekeeping is a fundamental strategic activity of the United Nations. You see more and more ungoverned or weakly governed spaces. You don't want chaos to spread. And often a peacekeeping mission, in a way, is the last stop before full chaos. So if you have as a strategic goal to prevent the spread of chaos, you have to take UN peacekeeping seriously. You need a new contract between the United Nations and its member states. You can't delegate to one category of nations peacekeeping and just wash your hands of it.
Is that an indictment of the United States and the big members of the Security Council in that lack of support?
I think in some ways it is. I think the developed countries, the countries with the most effective forces, should contribute more to peacekeeping. Now, the objection they have is they say, well, yes, but we're not completely confident on your chain of command. But I think in the present challenging environment, without highly trained troops, peacekeeping will be more and more difficult and will encounter failures.
Jean-Marie Gueno, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jean-Marie Gueno is the president of the International Crisis Group and author of The Fog of Peace, a memoir of international peacekeeping in the 21st century. Is the United Nations helping or hurting the situation in Nigeria? In northeastern Nigeria, violence and disruption by Boko Haram has caused widespread food shortages. More than 4 million people are reported to be severely food insecure, and several reports have stated the region is on the brink of famine. UNICEF says up to 50,000 children could die in northeast Nigeria unless they receive treatment soon. Chris Stein, the Nigeria correspondent for Voice of America, based in Lagos, is in San Francisco this week and says the Northeast is in many ways out of reach of traditional relief efforts.
You have agencies like UNICEF, MSF, the International Rescue Committee might be up there, who are able to kind of come to these towns and help out the NGOs. The thing is that access is limited. For instance, in the city of Bama, which is the second largest city in Borno State, getting access to Bama involves a military escort, even though It's only, I think, about 70 kilometers away from the state capital, Maiduguri, which is always, which is sort of a safe area. You need to have a military escort to take you down that road, and one isn't always available, and it's still dangerous. So even though there is access, it's sporadic, it's risky, it's probably not as much access as anyone would like.
What's the government's responsibility here?
Well, the government has a National Emergency Management Agency that does provide food aid. And then the states themselves, there are actually three affected states in the Northeast that have been hardest hit by Boko Haram. They have state emergency management agencies, and those two agencies divvy up a portioning of aid items. But I guess the issue is that, malnutrition is not just a lack of food, it's also a lack of clean water and issues of disease as well. And clearly that system has somehow broken down, or it isn't enough.
Is the UN at fault here for not responding quickly enough or in enough volume?
It's difficult for me to say who's at fault. I mean, I understand the World Food Program only opened an office in Nigeria in March. They're really just starting to scale up. There has been food insecurity in northeastern Nigeria for a long time, long before Boko Haram. But the gravity, the magnitude of this situation has only become clear recently, and aid agencies are only starting to respond, in part because huge swaths of northeastern Nigeria were just too dangerous for anybody to enter, except for perhaps the Nigerian military, for months. And so what humanitarian agencies are saying is that they're only recently finding out that there is this deep of malnutrition, and they have to sort of scale up their response and get the money they need.
What's the chance that this becomes of the scale of the 60s civil war in the independence war for Biafra?
I mean, the independence war for Biafra, the starvation caused there and the starvation happening in northeastern Nigeria are only really similar in that they are episodes of starvation happening in Nigeria. Other than that, the causes are kind of completely different.
The Nigerian government was very effective with Ebola. Is there a sense that this will eventually get up to speed and meet the needs?
Well, Ebola occurred in the country's southern cities, which are, comparatively easier to access. I mean, those are large urban areas where you have hospitals and you have government systems that are present and, are functional. In the Northeast, I mean, Boko Haram in territories they controlled, and they, at one point controlled, I believe, the majority of the local government areas in Borno State, have done a very thorough job in trying to erase the government institutions, government employees. So I don't know if we can confidently say that this will be responded to with the efficiency of Ebola, because this is a widespread problem. Ebola was a few hundred cases, people that needed to be watched. This is 4.4 million people in hard-to-reach areas with, major funding challenges, hitting Nigeria at a time when it's going into a recession. Fortunately, international aid agencies realize that. The UN is saying that they need $220 million for the whole Lake Chad region, $164 million for Nigeria alone to tackle this. But it's a much larger task with many more lives at stake than Ebola.
Chris Stein, the Nigeria correspondent for the Voice of America. Thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Music don't change the world.
There's something happening here.
Got to fight the power, don't be.
We shall overcome.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised.
Music don't change the world. Only the audience can change the world. But a good songwriter can offer a different perspective.
Which side are you on in this summer of 16? Singer Billy Bragg in 2014 was so certain of his side in British politics that he sang this tune on the day of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's death.
I'm bound to follow my conscience, and I'll do whatever I can. But it'll take much more than a union law to knock the fight out of a working man. And which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Over his 30-plus year career, Billy Bragg has never wavered as a voice of the left, with a spiritual lineage connecting him to the likes of Odetta and the anti-fascism of Dust Bowl troubadour Woody Guthrie. Bragg came out of the punk folk rebellion of the 1970s with the likes of The Clash, but he's a romantic who's written some fabulous love songs, too. On the night of the Brexit vote, he found himself on stage at the Glastonbury Festival with an audience of thousands of fellow Brits. The vote itself and the contradictions and implications of it made it difficult to take a side. Bragg says these days the importance of a songwriter to make sense of history as it happens has limits. There's only so much anyone with a guitar and a few lyrics can do, he says.
The most you can do with music don't change the world. The audience, only the audience can change the world. But a good songwriter can offer a different perspective, and that's what I try to do. I try to, you know, find the positives and work out, you know, join the dots in a different way from the way that's being done by the mainstream press.
But what's the emotional connection that you have with people? Because it's more than just you're connecting dots.
Yes, that's very, very true. That's very true. Well, music is a great leveler. It can encourage, and I think at its highest calling, it can encourage empathy with people that you never met. You hear a song about someone's problems and you think, you know, I really feel for them and their difficulty. Or you feel that, you know, you have that problem too. It, you know, music is really powerful in that sense. So if an event has just happened, if for instance, something cataclysmic has just occurred and that night you happen to go on stage and you're trying to articulate how you feel about that and people are connecting with that, then it becomes more than just a gig.
There's a lot that rhymes with Trump these days, Billy Bragg.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
There is, yeah. There's a lot of the rhymes with demagogue as well. There's something going on. It's not just in the United States of America. Trump isn't purely, obviously, it's an American phenomenon. But what's happening there, the movement away from what you might call centrist politics, is a common figure right across Europe. What Trump is trying to suggest is classic sort of trying to blame minorities within society for all of society's problems, when the real fundamentals, it seems to me, from what's being said in Europe and what's being said in United States of America, is actually a problem with the economy rather than a problem with people who don't look like us.
What song of your youth that you grew up with as a protest song that was really meaningful to you do you think would be meaningful today? And what artist do you think would be very active today as a protest singer, given those issues you've just outlined?
There was a lot of this kind of politics in punk. You know, bands like The Clash were trying to bring together white youth and black youth in the UK in the late 70s. That was very, very important in my political education.
Wild Riot, I wanna riot. Wild Riot, I ride on my own. Wild Riot, I wanna riot. Wild Riot, I ride on my own. Black man got a lot of problems, but they don't mind for the break. White people go to school, but they teach you how to behave.
But the one person I turn to in situations like that, like that we find ourselves in now, tend to be Woody Guthrie.
Put it there, boy, we'll show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do.
He had a deep, deep understanding of human nature, and he never wrote a cynical song in his life. And I think if you're going to write about politics, you have to try and make sure that you don't. I mean, we all feel cynical from time to time, but cynicism really is the enemy of all of us who want to make the world a better place.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
So you have to curb your cynicism and write songs that are positive and bring out empathy in people.
All you fascists bound to lose.
Yes.
All you fascists bound to lose. You bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
Again, as a songwriter, you're using words like demagogue, empathy. You know, these don't rhyme.
In the 80s, I was, you know, writing in more ideological terms, but now I find myself writing in a broader sense. You know, probably the most political song I sing now is a song called I Keep Faith.
If you want to meet the weather, you have to take the blame. If sometimes dark clouds fill the sky and it starts to rain.
Which is, you know, basically it speaks about keeping on, you know, it's difficult. As I say, cynicism is all around us. You switch on the TV, you read the newspapers, you start to think to yourself, nobody else cares about this stuff. You know, nothing ever changes.
Listen to your heart and you'll find me right by your side, because I keep faith. I keep faith. I keep faith in you. Yes, I do. I keep faith in you.
If you allow yourself to be curdled and assaulted by your own cynicism, you do end up those angry voters screaming at the top of their voice in your face, make America great again. Whenever I hear that phrase, all I want to know is, when was America great? When are they actually talking about? Because I've been coming to America for the last 35 years, and I think it's a pretty great place. I'll be honest with you. You know, it's changed over that time, but it's changed, mostly it's changed positive. There's some things, you know, I'll never understand, like why you don't have free healthcare and why you don't do something about guns. But that's, you know, I'm a foreigner in your country. But other than that, what's Trump afraid of? And these are strange times, you know, and it's not just you and it's not just us, but together, hanging on to each other, those of us who believe in internationalism and empathy and curbing our cynicism, we're going to get through this.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this...
Musician and activist Billy Bragg, his latest album, Shine a Light, Field Recordings from the Great American Railroad, is due out September 23rd.